Good afternoon, members, and I will call the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Petersburg, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
I so move their adoption.
Representative Petersburg moves the minutes of February 9th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Those minutes are approved. Today we have Commissioner Zelli back with us, and Commissioner, thank you for coming to our committee again, and we get the opportunity to look through the governor's budget. So thank you, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representatives Committee. I do have a presentation. It is the governor's budget proposal, and as I go through the proposal, I know I needn't tell you, but please feel free, if you'd like to ask questions along the way, I'd be delighted to go deeper into any issue. And if I don't know the answer, we have a number of MnDOT personnel, including our Chief Financial Officer, Tracy Hatch, who is here, Deputy Commissioner with me.
And Commissioner, I believe you've said no problem interrupting, and while we're on topic, we'll have the questions come your way.
Sure.
I think there might be a couple.
Okay.
So we'll proceed.
I can imagine. I won't spend a lot of time kind of reviewing the condition of the system, but I am going to refer to what some of the outcomes will be with funding. So, you know, in a way of a review, the system as it is not in what we call competitive shape. No mystery, 50% of the pavements are over 50 years old, 35% of the bridges are over 50 years old, and we're not in a climate that really favors infrastructure. We'll see this more in the spring, but there is it turns out pothole season year-round in the state of Minnesota, so we'll be hearing more about that as I get into the system presentation. The one thing I kind of you hear a lot is that it's not just the condition of the infrastructure, it's the increasing and changing need that they're using for all modes. And in particular, highways and bridges. I often spend time with the Department of Economic Development, and one of my favorite divisions there is Explore Minnesota, who touts extremely favorable statistics about the increasing role that tourism plays in our economy and, frankly, for the entire state, including Greater Minnesota. I'm always proud to point out that although I am not the first commissioner who is not an engineer, I am the first MnDOT commissioner who is a registered travel agent, so I actually do know that that some of the aspects of what we are selling in Minnesota are scenic byways and access to destinations. Freight is a continuing issue. We're actually meeting later on, I am, with a number of stakeholders concerned about freight rail congestion, this is a top priority for the governor. But it really spills onto the highways. We have congested waterways, highways, rail lines, and the fact that we will anticipate increasing amount of freight shipments throughout the entire state is both a kind of a favorable indicator of our robust economy, but it is a challenge to our transportation system. I'm going to get a little bit more specific, and we will over the course of the next, really the next couple of months, but we have pretty solid statistics about what will happen without additional funding. We have a number of our roadways, our pavements, are in poor condition. I think most people have their own stories about where roads and bridges are decaying. But without additional funding resources, we will see a gradual erosion in our pavements. And when we talk about a 75% increase in pavements, that is really looking at the actual ride conditions of our state highway system. When I talk about ride conditions, that's really a lot of measurements that we do to look at what the experience is for drivers driving over our roadways. This does not actually measure the deteriorating conditions of the substructure. Many times we're able, and we have been increasingly having thin overlays, that's asphalt over substructure where the actual pavements and the roadways will continue to deteriorate, and to the point where we find asphalt overlays may last 4 or 5 years. Then the next time we do it, it lasts maybe 2 or 3 years. And those of you who are driving over 394 or even 94 will see some of the recent repavements that occurred and felt great riding it for a number of years, about 4 or 5 years ago, start to see that crumbling apart today. So I want to emphasize that as we look at a 75% increase in the amount of poor roads, there actually is a more dramatic story when you look at the actual deterioration of the substructures. The traffic congestion, of course, is something that is in many parts of the state, but primarily in the metro area. We are measuring as much as 34 hours for every driver in the metro area sitting in traffic over the course of a year. We've measured the cost to Minnesota businesses coming through the metro at $232 million a year. This comes from the Texas A&M, that is the kind of the national experts on congestion measurement. I've checked it out with a few of our agricultural businesses, and they feel that this is a low number, that we actually probably have greater congestion costs above the $232 million a year. So I want to just jump right into the funding scenario, because I know this is really, if there is one slide that's the most substantive to look at and think about today, it is what outcomes occur at different funding levels. Again, this is a 10-year proposal, and as I alluded to, without additional revenue, we can account on not just deterioration, but bigger impacts in terms of the mobility throughout the state. If there isn't an additional funding, I've talked about what happens to pavements. Likewise, with bridges, we would expect almost a geometrically increasing amount of bridges to be in poor condition over the next 10 years. We would think as many as 640 bridges would be needing repairs or work to be done on them. Despite the funding that we got over the past number of years through both bonding and then the 2008 gas tax increase, we did a substantial amount of repairs on bridges and new bridges, but that really hasn't been able to keep pace because they continue to deteriorate. We're actually kind of, if you can think about it, reaching a bridge bubble. The bubble is all the bridges that were built in the 60s. We had a massive amounts of both interstates and national highway systems being built over 50 years ago, and they're just simply coming of age. That's where bridges, even more than pavements, are very expensive to replace, certainly, but they're also expensive to repair. If there is not additional funding, we will be doing more and more resurfacing on the cheap. That means overlays. We will do more patching, and we will not have. We will have limited funds for the expansion projects. We've been able to build a number of expansions with the Corridors of Commerce. That was really starting a lot of projects through bonding, both the $300 million of bonding and then from 2 years ago, and then the general fund allocation from last session. Much of that work was done to advance projects like Highway 14, Highway 23, do engineering on 94, do some studies. But without additional funding, none of those projects will be completed, except for those that are were construction projects. We are completing the 610 extension. We will be doing some of these new passing lanes. But in terms of the work that we're doing to do additional planning and engineering for, there wouldn't be any funding for. We do plan to have maybe one or two additional min pass lanes. We will complete I-35E here in St. Paul, possibly one more, but no more. And maybe when you get toward, when you look at what we are looking at with the $6 billion plan, there's a number of projects that we believe are critical to the state's economy that will not be funded, not just the corridors that I've mentioned, but I'll pick on one metro one in particular. That's the I-94 reconstruction. And that's a good way to explain what we talk to as scenario two for the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, the maintenance mode at $2.5 billion. I-94 repavement may actually fit in that scenario. That is a scenario where we keep the current conditions static. Well, keeping the current conditions static is actually, and this is hard to explain, but it pretty much is keeping the roadways and the bridges in a steady deteriorating state, if that makes sense. It is not improving the conditions of or modernizing the conditions of the overall system. We could repave 94, but with $2.5 billion of additional funding. But in 94, I mean between the two cities, St. Paul and Minneapolis. But if we were to repave 94, we'd actually have to bring it up to environmental standards. The environmental standards to repave 94 are substantially more than just keeping it in its current condition. Because of all the salt and the roadside pollutants that are on the pavements of 94 now, most of it flushes into the Mississippi River. That just was the standard in the 60s when it was built. If we were to repave it, we would have to make a substantial improvement to the culverts, cisterns that would be underneath the roadway. It is a much higher investment to modernize 94. So I'm just going to give you a sense of the complexity of rebuilding a deteriorating central artery to our metro area, which does need work. And I started 2 years ago, and I thought, well, at least I won't be the commissioner who has to deal with 94, because that is just really a huge project. But it turns out you actually have to plan that kind of project starting now. We actually dedicated part of the Corridors of Commerce funding to actually study and see exactly how we're going to do that. It's not just pavement reconstruction. It's replacing and widening as many as 15 bridges. And to add a transit corridor through a min-pass lane in that area would require both creativity and space and money. So if we were to just repave the project, which I think I can't recommend we do, because it wouldn't be compliant with current environmental laws. So in a way, the $2.5 billion to maintain is just a theory. It isn't really a practical concept, because when you are into projects, they need to be modernized. Modernized, an example would be the Lafayette Bridge, where we had funding through our bonding and additional revenue, where many bridges were brought up to code and up to becoming less redundant. The Lafayette Bridge was in worse shape than the I-94 bridge that fell down. We've replaced it with two modern bridges. It is not the same bridge, and yet it has the same capacity. It is not, in theory, an expansion project. It is simply a replacement project. But it does have the room to grow. It has the room to expand. And plus, it is not critically fracture critical. It has redundant systems. It's far safer. And it also has both pedestrian access and the ability to do maintenance. You can actually close half the bridge, one of the bridges at Lafayette, do work on that while traffic is diverted to the other bridge, kind of what we're doing now during the construction, and keep mobility going. So that is in a sense, is that maintenance? It's not. It's actually modernizing, doing a better job with the existing capacity so that it is a 100-year solution, not a 50-year solution. So that kind of gives you a flavor of what the difference is between maintenance and actually modernizing. We know that we have in our $6 billion proposal, the governor's proposal, $4 billion toward that modernization role for our system. When you think about existing capacity, we have a project in the range between Eveleth and Virginia, Highway 53, where some commissioner 50 years ago signed a lease. Turns out the state of Minnesota does not own the land, and we have to move a trunk highway. So many of you hear about the complicated project it is to actually relocate that 53 highway. We have found, we think, is the lowest cost option and one that is, I think, a very practical solution. And it is going through its environmental review and early design process. We are on schedule. It's an aggressive schedule, but we are on schedule to have that Highway 53 relocated before our lease runs up with the mine. The cost estimate for that project is between 180 and 240 million. Look here at my CFO. She's still smiling. Okay, so those are the right numbers. 180 to 240 million dollars. We have in our current state investment plan that is programmed at 61 million. So we actually have as much as $150-$200 million gap that we need to fund without additional revenue. That project, that one project alone, could be nearly $180 million. Without addition, it is part of our plan and the funds to be used to actually do that project. By June, we will continue with that environmental review. If we do not have funds available for that bridge, we do not. I can't see us proceeding with that project without a source. Other investments that we can go on, and we have a map, and we can certainly give you details about the sense of urgency that funding is required for many of these projects. As we look toward, again, preservation, modernization, and expansion, a lot of the work, the engineering, the planning that needs to be done on all these, including acquisition of right-of-way, happens right now. We can't do projects 2 or 3 years from now unless we plan, unless we're well along the way. Many times this 10-year plan actually has projects laid out multiple years ahead because not just for funding but for the actual work it takes in order to engineer, acquire, and then to work through with the various stakeholders the actual designs for the plans. So $6 billion, which is the governor's recommendation over a 10-year period, is just for the state highway system. Again, it involves both the preservation modernization element, which is the $4 billion of additional funding, plus $2 billion for strategic expansion. The Highway 53 is not a strategic expansion. That is really modernizing. But you'll see a number of different components, including many that we've discussed with corridors of commerce that is really finding additional capacity throughout the state. There could be interchanges. There could be passing lanes. In some cases, it's shifting a two-lane to a four-lane for both safety and economic capacity, such as Highway 14 between New Ulm and Rochester. Main Street projects that are the stars are a reconstruction project that enhanced the Main Street experience. I think I talked about those when I was here last. And again, in the metro area, a strategic expansion is largely the MinPass lanes. I'm just going to talk about the various strategies by components, and I won't spend a lot of time because I've been talking about it, But when we think about the actual categories, the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee looked at the capital portion of many of these, not all of these. We've taken a hard look at that and found areas that that needed to be addressed. So this is a far, that what we call Next 10 is a far more kind of comprehensive and we believe accurate depiction based on the same principles as the TFAC report in addressing competitive improvement system.
Commissioner, could we yeah. pause here? You've kind of moved on to the next subject, so if we could, a couple of questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So some of the veteran lawmakers here have expressed to those of us who were freshmen that come May to expect to have to go on vacation and take a break. And being that you said you're a registered travel agent, then perhaps you could...
I'm happy to help
provide some. Yeah, absolutely. But on the topic of travel and tourism, it's an interesting note here. It's intriguing. Tourism has increased by 54% in Minnesota since 2000. In the area of housing and real estate, it's very closely watched the trends of where growth is occurring. And I am wondering if you are aware of any information that would lead where in the state is tourism, this 54% growth, et cetera, and hence more usage of the roads in those areas.
Mr. Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, my understanding, and I would kind of defer to the Department of Economic Development, but I've been led to believe it is statewide. There is a large metropolitan component. Mall of America will claim a big piece of that because a number of even international visitors will come to that destination. But I've also learned that a lot of our resort areas throughout the greater Minnesota, the city of Duluth, Brainerd area is not just marketing fishing, but is marketing golf and other hiking recreation. We know that the Lanesboro area and true in Bemidji, that bike trails have become a huge tourist attraction. People actually will bring their families and go on trips, more inns and stops along the way, the antique shops and theaters in Lanesboro. So my sense is it is, you know, pretty evenly distributed around greater Minnesota and the metro, certainly the robust arts community, major destinations, hotels, convention business has been picking up from the Great Recession. And my understanding is from Meet Minneapolis, there's been some pretty healthy growth in the visitor and the hotel business. You find more and more, even though we haven't had an additional convention hotel, there's been more hotels generally, more hotel rooms, which is part of the way we're able to attract a Final Four and a Super Bowl is because we actually have hotel capacity because it's been a growth. So I think it's a very positive story, and these are new dollars to our state. So I think it's been actually tourism in the United States has increased too. There's more international visitors because people come and experience. They've seen New York, they've seen San Francisco, they want to see the middle part of the country, and that's where we come from.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming and sharing with us. Am I correct in assuming that the department would really like to have these additional funding sources? But do you, the department doesn't have a preference as to how or where the funds come from, do they?
Well, we have a recommendation that the governor has proposed. I guess there is two questions, maybe three. First is what's really needed to be competitive, and that's where I'm going to spend a lot of time. We have the principles that we think that are important for that investments would be long-term and dedicated, because for us to start work, we need to know that they're planned and dedicated to the trunk highway system in our case, so we do actually favor those funds which are both kind of user fees and ones that are focused on the system.
Okay. I have a couple follow-ups.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. In regards to road and just age and so forth, in your opinion or in your information, are our township and county roads farther behind us, or are they also suffering from the same issues as our trunk highways and state highway roads as well?
Mr. Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative, they are absolutely deteriorating, and in some cases worse, and other cases less so. When you think about the 144,000 miles of roadways in the entire state of Minnesota, the state system has roughly 12,000, so pretty small number. Yet we, the state system, carries you know, in excess of 50% of the traffic and most of the freight traffic, the heavy traffic that really deteriorates or is tough on roads. But so absolutely, counties and municipalities have a backlog or what we call deferred maintenance. They really do need some rehabilitation.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I've been hearing that a lot from my own townships and commissioners from counties as well, saying, hey, how about us? We need some more funds too. But getting back to actually really what I think you started to talking about was the sustainability, shall we say, or the dependability of funding coming forward. My question is, if because this would be an expansion of available resources for the department, how quickly could this be implemented and put into use? And how long a time frame do you need for that continued a supply of funds so that you can keep the projects moving?
Mr. Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we could put the funds to use immediately. We have both some projects underway. Highway 53 is a good example. Also, there are projects which we refer to as flex projects. They are on the shelf, ready to be deployed, but for the lack of funding. So, and those projects that take more time and engineering, we would and planning, we would embark on that. Part of the funding of our state road construction budget has approximately what we call 17% of the delivery cost. That's both our internal capacity and those of consultants who help us deliver those projects. So we kind of have that built into that number. So yeah. it is kind of a fully allocated you know, cost to actually deliver the work. So we're actually we think ready, and in fact you know, the need is there now, and we're ready now.
Okay. I'll defer other questions later.
Commissioner, since you mentioned that 17%, and that's in our current bid process, I assume, with lowest bid, what about alternative bid process when we get into design build? I assume we only take that so far, and then it's up to the contractors to take that engineering and that development the rest of the way. So what happens to that 17% at that time?
Well, that is that percentage is what we estimate if you look at its entirety, and every project is different. As you've heard before, I'm a big proponent for design build and manage design build. So you work hand in hand with design construction engineering firms to deliver projects. But not every project lends itself to that or lends itself to gaining efficiency from that. There is some project that really work much better for MnDOT to design internally and to manage the process and to put it out for low-cost bid. And we have numbers of projects that are smaller in scope that we regularly do that. So, and I think the idea that 17% is to kind of take it, you know, as an overall a number. Some would be considerably less, and others, you know, maybe more. But, you know, on average, we try to manage the costs so that we are being efficient, both internally and the cost that we pay others to help.
So, just to clarify, then, if we did move towards, if we were doing more design build projects, it would be safe to say that 17% should be lower.
What?
You know, I don't know. I can't say that. I'm going to look at my CFO, see if she has the thought. She's looking the other way. So, You know, I can't. I'll have to get back to you on that. I think the idea is every project has a different degree of complexity, and the more complexity, the more cost there is to deliver it. So I think to say design build naturally makes it more efficient probably gets a better outcome, but I'm not sure it always the less cost.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not quite sure of this, but I have a feeling that Representative Petersburger was asking you a question and you weren't quite hearing it. I think he was asking if they use the surplus one-time money, you don't care where the money comes from, that would solve your problem here. And I don't know how you'd answer that, but I know how I would answer it. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Well,
Mr. Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Earhart. When we talk about the $6 billion gap, that is derived from taking all the existing resources that we can count on, both federal and state resources, which include the any excess on whatever is in the fund. That's the unreserved fund balances that are in any of our forecasts. Those, on a regular basis, have been appropriated for the use that we use in our system. So we have considered in that $6 billion gap, we've already considered all sources of available reserves as part of our need. And we regularly do. That is part of our program. We regularly deploy unappropriated reserve funds for our program, and I can give you more specific examples, but that has already been counted. The $6 billion gap comes after all available resources, including those reserves.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I noticed that in the plan, one plan I've seen has $250 million out of the existing surplus, forecast surplus, excuse me, that is being offered to solve all or part of the problem here of the $6 billion, 6.6. I think it's more than that, because I'd like to go out 10 years full bore here, and I thought we ought to maybe think about 10 or 11 billion. Anyway, I think that it doesn't solve a lot if you have use 250 million, excuse me, out of the projected surplus for the biennium. I know you don't care where the money comes from, but it doesn't. The one-time money like that doesn't really solve what you're asking for. As we go on going here and trying, I don't know if you could even spend $300 million all at once or $400 million. Because you have to gear up for that, and you have to get your projects going, and you can only spend so much realistically a year.
Well, it depends on the project.
Mr. Zelli.
We actually have Mr. Chair. We have in the governor's proposal an additional, $699 million, and that actually could be but it is part of our programming horizon. So it's not like you spend it on one day, but these projects that can be advanced, we could actually deploy. And in the case of Highway 53, we're actually doing the work, kind of counting that there will be funding.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zelli, I want to start by saying that the folks along Highway 14 in Nicollet County appreciate you mentioning Highway 14 in a previous slide. And I kind of want to build on what Representative Earhart was asking about. If you go back to the previous slide, that the map that shows the potential projects, am I correct that basically gives us the picture of a $6 billion investment over the next 10 years?
Yes, that's a $6 billion plus the known sources of funding that we have.
So the additional $6 billion.
But this map really highlights what can be advanced with the $6 billion. Yes.
Jim Johnson.
So then it seems obvious to me, but maybe you can confirm for me, if we made a short-term investment of 1/10 of that or 1/20 of that, we would expect about 1/10 of this or 1/20 of this to be built or be committed towards being completed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, actually less than that, because if there was only a short-term funding, I would recommend we keep with the patching and the thin overlays, because the inadequate resources to do the true reconstructions wouldn't be there, so we would have to spread the lesser amount over a number of less efficient projects, just to keep the system from big potholes, basically.
Representative Johnson,
thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. So when my neighbors ask me to find a pathway to complete Highway 14 four-lane from Nicollet to New Ulm, possibilities are actually diminished by a lower percent, or diminished more, if we don't make this sort of a long-term commitment now. Am I hearing that correctly?
Mr. Chair, I have to be really candid that the highest priority is to preserve and maintain the system we have. And to the extent that Highway 14 is an expansion project, it would fall off without the comprehensive funding that provides for both modernization of the system, keeping pace and modernizing it, and then providing that additional strategic expansion. So that would be a wonderful strategic expansion project.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, always a pleasure. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Going back to a little bit of a previous conversation about design build and design bid build and everything, and obviously trying to save money, there have been instances when we've designed, bid, and built where the low bidder has not gotten the job. And could you explain that a little bit to me? I understand that we have to have responsible contractors and things, but in these days of very tight dollars, how does that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the best value sometimes is in the eye of the beholder. So we try to take all the subjectivity and put together a very prudent and transparent process to help identify on a number of factors, including cost, but also the criteria for any specific project that would deem to be important, like keeping access open for during the construction period. We want lanes to be open, and another would be to keep the timing short. Can you do it? How quickly can you do it? There might be factors relating to some safety protocols. Every contractor engaged in that process has equal opportunities to develop a case, to be interviewed, and to put together their bid or their proposal that is evaluated by a panel of people. And I actually think the AGC has raised to a point the number of people on that panel, and they're actually scored, and those scores are available to be seen. So in many cases, we think it serves the public to keep the mobility open, because I-35 is a great example. Or let's pick on Highway 100 this summer. We could do it at a much lower cost if we just closed the road for the summer and not pay overtime and just do it during the day. But we recognize in keeping lanes open, doing it as quickly as possible, paying more for overtime to do it 24 hours a day through the weekends, it's such an economic return for the users of the system, our economy, that we think that some of those metrics go beyond just the dollars that MnDOT pays, but to the stakeholders who really care. Representative Ugel.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Commissioner, but when you're doing this and you're talking about, okay, keeping the traffic lanes open, doing it in such a period of time and everything else, in design, bid, build, aren't you writing those into the specifications of the bid so everybody is bidding this on an equal basis? I know you can't write in everything. I know there's going to be change orders and all this, but shouldn't everybody, at least in this case, be bidding exactly the same thing so you don't have to score it?
Mr. Zilli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The actual scoring is on putting metrics behind some of those goals and criteria that everybody, that stakeholders in MnDOT believes is important. So it is a way to kind of quantify, and that actual dollar cost is one criteria, but it's not the only one. So we've found cases where contractors are disappointed, but when you actually start going through the arithmetic, I have found that, yes, in fact, this was the consensus. There is actually an appeals process where it goes outside of MnDOT. It goes to Office Administration to, you know, have another look to see if it was fairly, adjudicated, and then it comes back as a, and then it comes actually back to me and as a recommendation. And so when I've looked at those appeals, I've kind of thoughtfully said, you know, I've had cases where a contractor says, geez, you know, this project was scoped out where these exits would be open, and then at the end of the day, they weren't. When they actually built it, they were closed. And I took that feedback that hard, and I looked into it, and it was actually, no, actually those exits were determined to be closed all along. So to answer your quick question, is it should be fair, it should be transparent, and it should be fully disclosed. So that's the process.
Okay. Commissioner, if I could, and then I want to allow you to move forward here. If you could just go back two slides for me, please, and what's in store. Because one of the things I know you, the next slide, the what's in store, there you go. Because you said you're going to talk about need quite a bit. I just want some clarification, because if we look at the MnSHIP plan, the State Highway Investment Plan, it says that 4 to 5% of our system roads will fall into a poor classification, where you have up there a 75% increase, which would show a 9% actually in road miles. And this is part of the issue that we face is an agreement on need. So how do we get our arms around these numbers that you show here, and then actually looking at the 2014 report that shows it 50% less? So I really would like to have some type of understanding on what reports we look at, what numbers we look at, and that is really our job here.
And these ratings of poor condition is actually a technical term, so they should be very consistent with MnSHIP and with our what our next stand forecast show. But I would be happy to come back and or share with you some of our pavement asset management models that actually go into not just that ride condition, but the point I was discussing, which is actual kind of asset condition. So we have a service life for assets like roadways or bridges, where they will have a kind of a useful life, what we could reasonably expect. Times when it should be reconditioned, times that we would expect the roadway to have a what we call a useful life, same way as we have with vehicles or airplanes. That's another subject, we do have pavement models, and we can go, you know, deep into those or share those.
And I would appreciate that, Commissioner. And I'm certainly for our committee's standpoint, we would like to see it. But I would assume MnSHIP, in putting those numbers together, use the same models and come up with the same figures. So that is really why we are trying to have these conversations. It isn't just to kick the can down the road. It is to reach agreement around this table, especially of what that need is. So so we need to understand what the numbers are and why there's such a difference. So with that, I'm going to please proceed for a while, and members, I'm going to have the commissioner proceed for a while, and then we'll take more questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was advancing through the Next 10 strategies, which are, and each of these areas has you know, a body of work and in terms of our own studies to support. As we talked about pavements, again, we are targeting segments with no remaining service life. So we can give you the models that show that these segments have no remaining service life. Now, having said that, we will show maps that show those roadways. But because of the our climate conditions, changing traffic patterns, roadways may not, just like predicting the weather, fall exactly in 8 years from now as what we would have thought today. So they are models, they're forecasting models, and we think that they're we've gone pretty far at getting as much science and good engineering in this as possible, but they are illustrative and we think accurate. But you know, will it be that road or another road, that's where it kind of might vary in the 8 to 10 years outlook. But I think it's a pretty substantive grounding in the, as I say, the arithmetic. Same as in bridges, Twin Cities mobility is a whole category we've looked at, which is about making transit ways. Transit ways is just a way to say to drive more capacity through the system. We think a general purpose lanes don't carry as many people as those min pass lanes. We think they're very efficient in terms of adding capacity for people, working hand in hand with Met Council and our transit partners to integrate the systems. To the extent that we take cars off the road by going into min pass lanes, it provides more capacity in the general purpose lanes for freight movements. So we kind of think, you know, everybody wins by creating more capacity with the existing pavements. Greater Minnesota mobility is equally important. That's where we're looking at these interregional corridors. That's really the area that Corridors of Commerce addresses, as well as just the priority we give to our interstates and our national highway system. The national highway system are those major trunk highways that are part of our state system. Safety, clearly a very important component. It has been a longstanding high priority for MnDOT and our sister agencies and local government. We work hand-in-hand with the Department of Health, Department of Public Safety, and we do really all the engineering and the work to we think makes a huge difference, and we've seen some good results over the past 10 years. It works best when we bring many of these issues together, where we make not just reconstruct pavement, but we add safety improvements while we're doing that work. Bicycle infrastructure is something that is not just for bike lanes that are separate. They're actually part of our roadway, and we notice on the local projects that we're working, particularly on Main Street, but in elsewhere, bikeways is more than recreation. Actually, becomes a part of the mobility solution for people getting to work and getting to school. Likewise, pedestrian infrastructure fits into how we address the deficiencies of pedestrian space, people getting around cities. You'll notice we'll have more emphasis when we are reconstructing Snelling Avenue pavements. We are thinking more broadly about how we bring it up to a modernized kind of system. By making sure that people have mobility, not just on a car, but getting around once they get out of the car or the bus. A few areas that weren't part of the Transportation Plans Advisory Committee, but a really important part of the system, we look at roadside infrastructure. Includes everything from, I call them ditches, but the engineers call them culverts, but that's all the hydrology that goes around our highways. It's not just environmental codes, it's kind of best practices and in terms of everything that's in our right-of-way, but it's not just on the road. Maintaining and upgrading MnDOT facilities, not only is work that needs to be done, but it helps make MnDOT more efficient I know that, being a bus guy, that it's not just about the bus, it's about the maintenance garage as well. And if you can do become more efficient with all of our many truck stations and facilities, we have to not modernize each one, but to make sure that they're not eroding and make sure that we're being efficient in that investment area. And then the whole larger category of local partnerships, and it includes some of that Main Street work, as well as meeting some of the local objectives when we're working up trunk highway through a local jurisdiction that I've talked about. It could also include areas of jurisdictional alignment. That is, should this road continue to be a state road, or is it better suited to be a county road? Or is it a county road that should be a state road? So there's a way to kind of rationalize the system and some of the investment criteria we need to look to make sure we're setting this up for something beyond just the next 10 years. It's about how do we rationalize the system. And so that's an investment category that's looked to in our next 10 program.
Commissioner, I think this is a good place to break as well. Thank you, members, for your patience. Representative Norton?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to back you up for just a minute to the map and a follow-up on Representative Johnson's comments earlier. So I was understanding what you were saying about your plan and how this needs to be funded, but there are other plans out there. I've carried the local road and bridge bonding bill in the past, and I know how very important that is to the folks in my community. I've been very supportive of corridors of commerce, and Highway 14, of course, in southern Minnesota, is it's key, and all the way to the other, my colleagues' town and beyond. And so some of the proposals out there are using, I think, one-time money for local roads and bridges moving ahead. And as I'm looking at your map and the needs and the thinking of corridors of commerce and the needs in my area, can we use local road and bridge money to do these green areas you have on your map?
Commissioner Zilli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, well, the short answer is no. The general...
I was afraid you were going to say that.
And actually, I will get a little to county and local funding needs, because they shouldn't be ignored. Mm-hmm. And many times they work in partnership with state projects. But the general rule is that general obligation bonds cannot be spent on the trunk highway system. And trunk highway funds and trunk highway bonds cannot be spent on a local system, which makes it sometimes complicated. But we do administer a state aid program, which is both federal funds and an allocation of the user fees, the gas tax and the MBEST and the registration fees go into a distribution formula where roughly 40% goes to roughly to counties and municipalities and local townships, and that helps address some of the local road needs, but also helps to find some of the cost participation. When MnDOT is doing a project, there's often a local match, and part of the distribution formula helps fund that. So there's definitely a need, and there's and certainly the general obligation, the bonding bill from general obligation bonds, have often had a strong, local bridge and road component. And we do have a local road and bridge a grant program where we actually give grants to, so we help administer some of that, those funds.
And Mr. Chair, and I guess what I'm getting at is when we talk local road and bridges, we're not talking about Highway 14. Local road and bridges are a different beast, if you will.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Zilli.
President, the trunk Highway 14 is a state highway, and there may be I'll pick on a recent project, trunk Highway 52 to Rochester. We opened a separation, so we actually changed a very dangerous intersection by having a county road 9 that mm-hmm. that came across. Well, that interchange was funded with a number of sources, including some grants that came from MnDOT specifically for some county project, but it came from some general fund that we allocate, and then some trunk highway money because it involved the trunk highway. So sometimes those, when they come together, they get more complicated, but we're able to often stitch together various grant programs to address those needs.
And so, Mr. Chair, as we move ahead, some of us have great concern about these green areas and others and other needs in the state. And so I'm hoping that we can continue, while we may not around this table all agree with everything in the governor's proposal, I think we need to really look carefully at the really diverse needs across the state and the different funding sources and not put all our eggs in one basket so projects like Highway 14 and Highway 10 and others aren't kind of left in the dust.
Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr.
Powell. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again, Commissioner. My question stems to follow up on Representative Earhart's comment to where if we gave you all the money, you couldn't spend it all in one spot anyway or in 1 year.
I'd try.
And I'd love to give it to you to try, but in reality, it reminds me of the conversation we had out in Wilmer when we talked about the corridors of commerce. And we were talking about Highway 23 and the funding that we got to do the environmental study. But the comment that was made was, if we had the money today, construction wouldn't start until 19. That concerns me. If those dollars are there today, you're that far out to start moving dirt. Can you expound on that? If that's just to Highway 23, or is that the Highway 14? Is that the 94 exactly? Does that apply to all of our deals? And I know there's a lot of engineering, but I'm here also hearing from you that the engineering plans are, they're on the shelf collecting dust and ready to go. Highway 23 has been in the pipeline for as long as I can remember. Highway 14, probably since I was probably 15 years old, been in the pipeline. So I guess I'm a little concerned that these how this works.
Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, it's a great question. And the way I kind of think of it is that there's projects we've been talking about for years, but we actually haven't advanced through. Maybe we've done a preliminary study, but we actually haven't done preliminary engineering. And in many cases, the really important thing is actually buying the right-of-way, which takes time. Go out, buy land for expansion, so maybe for some lane expansion, maybe interchange, which requires more of a farmer's field. That takes time. So Highway 23 expansion, which is now to not wait till we have the money available, the Corridors of Commerce funding actually allowed us to, let's get a head start. Let's start doing some of that preliminary work, which is more than just studying and talking about it, but actually getting it ready. When I say that there's work that can be advanced right away now, there are a number of projects which we refer to as flex projects, not in that case Highway 23, but other preservation projects, projects that we have in our plan, in our pipeline, but we're able to start those right away, and to the extent that frees up resources we're counting on later on, then we'll know we can move forward with 23 and bring that online in 2018, even though it will take us a few years to get there. Without the funding commitment, we don't even get to buy the land and get ready, and it just keeps pushing it 3 or 4 years out forever. So there actually is, if you look at it as a system as a whole, there is a opportunity to deploy funding this year and to keep that chain of events moving.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you've got projects that are flex projects that are ready to go, you got a list of those that we could see on what are flex projects that are engineered, ready to go? Can we get that list? I'd like to see that.
I'm Mr. Chair, and I was happy to share that. I don't have them with me, but we can give you a sense of that we have opportunities for work that can be advanced. The best place to look would be in our TPIC, our Transportation Planning Investment Plan, which is a 4-year, very project-specific and we can kind of name many of them would be preservation projects and others. But that kind of gives you a sense that this is a an ongoing process that you know that kind of starts in any one time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, you keep going back to the point that if there's not dedicated funds, certain projects just don't make it to the top of the list. And we know that 33 other states use general funding for transportation. How do they plan? How do they get their projects done? What are we doing so different than all those states?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. We actually have general funds money that goes to transportation. Mostly it's local roads and bridges, but we've used general fund money to advance corridors of commerce last year. And if you actually look at those 33 states, I don't have the exact figure, but I think that accounts for approximately 5% of their entire transportation program. So I think that I don't know of a state that has only general fund. And I think that the general fund is obviously a very appropriate tool, but it doesn't give that dedicated ongoing stream upon which you build a program.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
I think over the years I've become very immune to the hypersensitivity and this thing that the government and the media love to keep passing around, what I consider management by crisis. And I see that in so many different things. With MnDOT specifically, there are things, projects that I see accelerated to the point. I got a really good example. This 371 project that went from Little Falls up to Baxter about 10 years ago. Entire thing done, expanding this from a two-lane to a four-lane highway in one summer. Unreal. Never seen anything like that. Bridges, everything, were all done in one summer. Yet, for the last 40 years, there's this little five-mile section around Wadena of Highway 10 that is still sitting there as a two-lane from one border to the other. It just sits there. I remember my dad even talking about this same project when he was in the Senate. It's still there as a two-lane. Someday. I doubt it'll get done in the next couple of years. So, again, I'm immune to the hypersensitivity. Looking at this $6 billion figure over 10 years, I just sat here and was crunching numbers. That's basically $600 million a year, okay? Now, if there were, let's say, 4 million people in the state, 18 and older, just 4 million, and we ran the numbers of $600 million a year, that's basically $150 a person per year. Now, I'm not a fan of hidden taxes because once they're implemented, they never, ever go away. This tax that's being proposed on here is a hidden tax. Nobody feels it. I'm looking at the room right here, and I would survey everybody in here. I almost guarantee you everybody in here would send you $150 a month to at least start working on this $6 billion investment instead of hidden taxes. There's other means to do this, but we always seem to go to this hidden way of government, which always just irks me. It irks the people up in my district. Somehow, somewhere, somebody's got a means to do this without going after the hidden tax mode. You know, again, if I come back to my $150 a month or $150 a year example for anybody that's, if we come up with 4 million people, that's $12.50 a month. I see commercials on TV looking to pay the puppies that much. Isn't there another means without going to hidden taxes on this? Has anybody in your department outside of the governor looked at any other funding sources besides hidden stuff? That was kind of long, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I actually appreciate the question because I think around the country, myself, many experts have looked at many different ways to fund this very expensive infrastructure system. It may, and I share and understand that it may seem hidden, but I attest to the transparency of every one of our funding mechanisms as being about as open as you possibly could imagine, if you look, and we can certainly be there to answer every question. Is it a hidden tax? First off, I think everybody in this room, if they drive or if they know somebody who does, actually is calculate going to be spending more than that $150 in car repairs, front end alignments, rims that are damaged. So, in fact, I think we have many costs that are facing us as a society that can be mitigated through proper investment and asset management techniques. And we, and I am committed that we do that prudently, and that we actually not only save costs by staying on top of maintaining a system that we all own, but also kind of make sure that's not a damper on our economy and the economic prosperity that I think we're beginning to enjoy, and we want to make sure we keep that going. So I think that if we follow the arithmetic, we actually find that it is one that would, over time, help add more resources to everybody in this room beyond the $12.50 per month that it costs.
And Commissioner, let's proceed with your slides. I think you're right on cue here to talk about that revenue source.
All right, $7 billion, and this is just a quick summary of what I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. It is, as we've all heard, a 6.5% excise tax on fuel with a floor of $2.50. It is raising the registration fee and $2 billion in bonding and MnDOT efficiencies of up to 15% of new revenues, and that's really the bulk of the $6 billion gap for the state system. In addition to the $6 billion, and important to point out that these fees actually generate roughly $2.3 billion of additional resources for counties, cities, and townships. The outcomes I'm describing here relate only to the state system of roads and bridges, but there are obviously benefits to the county and city systems as well. Just a quick couple of words on what this ghost receipts tax is. And maybe what it is not. It is a tax, an excise tax, at this exactly the same spot in the process that the current fuel tax is sits. So it is as transparent or as effectively deployed as the current fuel tax. The only difference is this is one that it adjusts annually, the idea is that it would keep pace with construction costs. So it is a new form of a revenue. It is one where it is added to the motor vehicle sales tax and the registration tax and the traditional fixed fuel tax that would arise over time with energy costs, which is one of the drivers of MnDOT's costs. So I think, like any business, it's nice to have a diversified portfolio of revenue, and why wouldn't we not have one element, which is not the most significant, but it is one element that would rise or fall with the cost of energy, which if you look at MnDOT's costs of fleet fuels, asphalt, and even construction costs are often driven by energy costs. If it goes up to $4 a gallon, maybe that would add another $4 a month to the $12, but I would suggest that if that happens, those energy costs are going to be built into every product and service that the citizens of Minnesota buy, and we will see much more cost to the economy from those revenues going to not to the state of Minnesota, but to frankly energy companies. So I don't think it is quite as draconian when you look at the actual dollars and cents. The important point is that fuel tax is an imperfect user fee because of the efficiencies of cars, because people are driving less. And I think for a 10-year outlook, it has been deployed by many states. 12 other states are doing it. Many of them are Republican governors, so I think it has been a very embraced at least nationally by many, on a nonpartisan basis as an effective solution for not having to go back every 4 years because of the low purchasing power of a fixed gas tax. Additional investments beyond the trunk highway system in the governor's recommendation is some general fund investments for Greater Minnesota Transit and for bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, most notably the safe routes to schools. Again, these are the $120 million is over a 10-year period. This is actually less than what the TFAC called for, but that is because since the TFAC report came out, we've had more robust sales of leased cars, so there's funds that we believe are adequate, and this would be the amount to reach that 90% of the forecasted need for all of Greater Minnesota's transit needs. Again, this is really getting in now to the next 2 years. So if we look at that 10-year outlook, that really gets to the question that Representative Howe and others have asked about what would you do with this additional investment right now. And so part of the governor's budget for this biennium has a $700 million of additional funds for our program. $49 million of that is offsets some of the increased costs due to inflation from the last base period. That is cost of commodities, cost of personnel. Personnel would be a 1.8% increase. If we look at the cost of salt, sand, asphalt, we've actually seen some pretty big increases that go beyond the CPI of most other commodities. And this is getting back to this funding source. Yes, this is coming from new revenues, but actually $168 million is coming from our existing fund balance. We, regular basis, ask for appropriation of fund balance for a number of different reasons, but we generally do apply that toward the cost of our increases of our system, and in some cases the fund balance is there for flood and snow and ice cost overruns. But in this case, in this budget, it is the governor's request is for the $700 million over the 2 years. We also then, for the 2 year period, the Greater Minnesota Transit would be $10 million, $5 million for each year. It would, the next 10 proposal has that amount increasing in year 3, 4, and 5. But we believe as we build out the Greater Minnesota Transit, which is increasingly seen as a need for seniors and for Greater Minnesota generally, we believe $5 million per year meets the need. And again, likewise with the bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. I just want to show this slide here because I think this is really helpful to kind of give a grounding as to all these numbers that are flying around. Because a lot of times I read in the newspaper, people are confused about there's this $11 billion need, and then I keep talking about $6 billion where's the local need? So I just kind of want to frame this so that everybody kind of understands that these numbers are consistent. And we do talk about the governor's proposal of $11 billion over 10 years transportation. But they do come from both those dedicated funds for roads and bridges that go into a formula, constitutionally dedicated. There's general funds going for the transit sales tax in the metro area for transit, the bike and ped. If you look at the $6 billion, that is after the trunk highway user distribution formula that divides it between the state system and the city and township. So I think this kind of helps summarize the sometimes you hear different numbers, you think that we're actually changing the story, but it actually flows pretty neatly together.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we'll proceed with a few more questions here. It's a good stopping point. Representative Runbeck.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, this $6 billion number, it's hard to get much more detail on it. And I'm just curious, can you tell us how many new lane miles of highway it would build? I mean, one reason I ask is that the Met Council's Thrive 2040 plan pretty much says we're not building any more new roadways. So is that, I mean, do we get anything expanded out of this?
Well, out of the $6 billion, there's, excuse me, Mr. Chair, there's about $2 billion is for strategic expansion. There really is not new roads in that $2 billion over 10 years. It is really dedicated, in some cases, for new lanes, like Highway 14 or 23. It is in the metro area. If you look at the Met Council's Thrive plan, it is primarily for interchanges, for MinPass lanes, which provide additional capacity, and for, in some cases, like 494, we've put in some general purpose lanes, and we're looking at 694, some managed lanes, which are not MinPass lanes, but they do provide extra car capacity. So there is, but it's done on a very strategic basis. It's not new, they're not new roads really in that number, but there is capacity expansion throughout the state.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just have a follow-up? We've seen some information that Minnesota's highway construction costs are higher than many other states. And I don't know if you've seen the same information, but do you have any comments on that?
I would love to see that. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative, I've the numbers I've seen that we're very competitive on a per mile basis of our roadways and our capital costs, and I actually the numbers I've seen that put us in on as to be extremely competitive, particularly with our surrounding states. But so I'd be interested in that source. I haven't seen it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to share that with you.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, it sounds like what I thought I heard you say was that the governor's and maybe your interpretation of roads and bridges includes bike paths and bike trails around the state. Is that what we're seeing and hearing?
Mr. Chair, there is funding that we have in the governor's proposal specifically dedicated to some bike infrastructure. Safe routes to schools is not just bike lanes. In many cases, it could be curb cuts. In some cases, it's programs to help develop safe conditions for getting to and from school. But in the general case, we know that building, particularly with our local partners, capacities for bikes being part of the roadway is certainly part of our vision. We do not believe at MnDOT that all roads are for bikes, but we think that there is a bike infrastructure component to the state of Minnesota, and so that's it. You know, bikes are not on interstates. They're not on certain trunk highways, but in some cases they are. We have to, and I think that we are working and developing the finer points on a statewide bicycle plan that helps pull together both county and city plans, but also kind of a statewide system to know that when it makes sense, when it doesn't. But we're not building any new bike trails across the state, if that's your question.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. We're spending money from the legacy funds every year on this, millions of dollars. We still don't know how many people even use the bike trails, but we're building more all over the state. And so people in my district want to see roads and bridges built. Greater Minnesota Transit. Let's take care of helping the disabled folks and the elderly folks get to where they need to do with transit
We don't need to expand it beyond that. Use that money for roads and bridges. That's what my constituents will say. So I'm looking at this kind of with a different type of eye here and wondering which direction we're going. And bike trails, our folks, they want roads and bridges, and bike trails aren't roads and bridges.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, Representative Krakowski, none of these bike funds are going toward building DNR trails. Those are separate. The legacy funds are going toward the Paul Bunyan trails. That is not what this system is. This is more in urban areas, and we think there needs to be more comprehensive planning. So a lot of that is what we're doing, and to the extent we work with Safe Routes to Schools, I think that if you look at the greater scheme, this is not it's a lot of $75 million, a lot of money, but over 10 years, it really is not addressing building new trails.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Diskowski.
Commissioner, who has the county bike coordinators in the state? Is that MnDOT or is that DNR? I understand that we're hiring people all over the state to talk about where the next bike trail will go.
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jarkowski, I need to get back to you on that. We work collaboratively. We have a bike department that is not hiring people around the state. We work collaboratively with the health department and with DNR on a lot of those issues. So, that is really not a MnDOT.
Thank
we
you.
We have a bike program, but it's not what you described.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you got this committee. No, just Commissioner, welcome. Good to see you again. I have just a couple things I'll do really quickly. Representative Uglum touched on, he kind of incorporated design build, and then at one point I think he mentioned bid too. I just want to clarify in Minnesota that most of the work MnDOT does is low bid contract work, and that you're by law have to award it to the lowest responsible bidder, and the criteria is quite well set, correct?
That's correct.
Commissioner Zell.
Thank you. And when we refer to design build, there you don't have all the criteria forward, things like maybe the type of bridge that's going to be built or the time the contractor has to do the construction or whether they float the bridge in place like they did in Hastings or build it in place are left up to the contractor, or whether it's an arch bridge or precast concrete bridge in some cases are even left up to the contractor. So you have a professional scoring group that looks at that to determine what's the best value. And certainly price is included, but long-term maintenance, things like that are included. That process has been one that MnDOT's used more in recent years, and successfully, I would argue, but also one that potentially leads to more litigation because it is subject to in some interpretation as opposed to a straight bid contract. Would that be true? I just wanted to clarify because I think there was some misunderstanding that you have the flexibility if you can pick the second bidder because you think they're a better contractor.
No, that, Ms. Chair, and Representative McMahon, you totally got that right. It is intended to be very objective, but to be more criteria. And actually, when you are, it's not... Bulk of our smaller projects are pure low-cost bids, so you made a great point. It doesn't fit for every project. But those that are more complicated, like, for instance, the Corridors of Commerce extending 610 to I-94, we actually saved $20 million, maybe more, because the contractor design says, if we replace these bridges and actually make... I'm not an engineer, but I'm just... It's what I understand. Make these bridges straight rather than curved, we actually can do that at a lot lower cost and we'll get all the performance that we would otherwise. Why don't we save $20 million? So that's why it's great to collaborate with, and you're right, you actually find more cost savings when you are aligned with a contractor and a designer as opposed to just trying to...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I would suggest that you don't remind us anymore that you're a travel agent and a bus guy because you are hiding the fact that you are not a civil engineer very well. You have done a terrific job of coming to this department in an unbelievably tough time And my personal experience of dealing with you have been extremely great. You helped out a very difficult situation. You made the correct decision that saved the state of Minnesota $800,000 in a very tough situation, and you did the right thing. Yeah. And I really think with the tough spot we're in that you're the right person to be there. I want to ask one thing about the wholesale gas tax, or the wholesale tax on gas as opposed to gas tax. Do you not have the authority, or can we not put a gas tax in place that goes up and down as pennies on the gas tax with the price of gas? Or why do you pick the wholesale price of gas? Why don't you just put it on gas tax, but it has a floor and a roof maybe? Is that not, it seems like you're doing the same thing, and I'm trying to understand why.
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and thank you for your confidence. I'm also not an attorney, I'll tell you. I don't know the exact
way. No, because the attorneys, thank you, Mr. Chair, the attorneys said you shouldn't do what you did, and you did the right thing because you knew it was the right thing. And the attorneys were wrong, and you and I and Senator Sieben were right. That you shouldn't listen to the attorneys, you should do the right thing. And they ended up not, and you ended up not getting sued, and you saved the state $800,000. And, so thank you.
No disrespect to any attorneys in the room.
Yeah. I've always had a lot of love for him, Mr. Chair.
And I appreciate that story, and you're right. We did the right thing, and I have every intention of doing the right thing. And that was, I appreciate that opportunity that we did.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll concur. I think it's great to have a businessman at the helm of MnDOT, and an excellent one at that. You mentioned, Commissioner Zelli, just in passing briefly, the issue of the unreserved fund balance. And I wanted to get a little bit more information on that. I know that, and Mr. Chair, you said that this is a large part of House File 4, which is the current plan on the table from the majority, and you said, Mr. Chair, last week, there might be more coming or a different version, so I wanted to, you know, with that caveat. So the current plan calls a significant part of the revenue comes from this unreserved fund balance. And my understanding is that this is actual money, that it's a projection, it's an expectation, and that it's spent. It's not just money that's sitting there. The department spends it. So would it be accurate to say this, you know, this isn't really new money that's going to be reallocated somehow, that this is money that the department spends, and if so, on what? Just maybe shed a little bit more light on this unreserved fund balance, since it is, you know, a significant part of the current Republican plan on the table.
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, the fund balance, the unreserved fund balance, as a matter of course, is what we consider as being dedicated funds for our future needs. And it is our regular practice, because we must have all these dedicated funds appropriated, we carefully budget a base budget, but knowing that there will be excess funds, we plan for those funds. And certainly if you take a 10-year outlook, we have counted those as part of the forecast to be funds available for our program.
So
Mr. Chair, so this isn't unspent money that's just sort of lying around. It's you know, money that you're projecting for, that you appropriate, that's used, existing money that's used for existing road and bridge projects. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am still looking for that money lying around. And
okay.
I have not found it. No.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Mr. Zell.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And maybe if I can also ask along those same lines. But that is money that's been appropriated. So if my son comes to me and wants to buy a car and says, Dad, can I have $10,000? And instead of buying a car, he buys a moped for $1,000. And then he comes the next year and says, but now I'm going to college and I need a car, so give me $10,000. Isn't my first question going to be, well, what about that $9,000 that I gave you last year? Isn't that unappropriate? It's unspent, but it was appropriated money that he had, and now he's coming back to me and asking for more. So those were dollars that were appropriated for a project. They were not used. So where are they?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go and follow up the actual dollars in each case, but I think if my son had an understanding that he had certain costs that he would have year after year, and I would be able to provide him funds for those costs, I would want to make sure that he's fully disclosing the use of those funds and that they're there that we all agree on. And that's what we do with the funds that come to our to this account. And there are at times that we think it's prudent to have reserves because on a regular basis there are issues like the floods in Duluth or the excessive snowfalls 2 years ago where we actually draw on those funds for emergencies. So those weren't, we didn't actually budget for those emergencies. But on the other hand, as part of our normal course and as we project forward, we have been really applying those funds with a full expectation that they would be available and that they would be appropriated.
I appreciate that, Commissioner. But these have been used throughout historically. I mean, the governor had his Better Roads for Minnesota and used the exact same funding mechanism. So it's not that they haven't been used before. But I would like you to please respond to one thing on the gross receipts. Now, since we were talking about that, one of the things, and people are having a little bit of a problem with the transparency of it, because what is proposed is a $2.60 minimum, which is a 17-cent tax. So if we look at historically since 2008, if we actually had implemented this plan, the rate of inflation on that tax, based on the prices throughout that time period, ranges from 6 to 10%, never less than 6%. So we have a 6%, 10%, 8.7% during that time period. And during that same time period, we have an inflation rate of approximately 1.2%. So the problem we're having with the gross receipts tax is that it is not something that we can, as Representative McNamara was talking about, a sales tax of 8 cents or knowing that the 3 cents was going to go on just a couple years ago. It's this matter that we don't understand what that's going to do. And when we're in a period of rising gas prices, which we'll probably enter into again, and inflation not keeping up, so cost of living raises and things, that's where it's going to be hitting people the hardest. So why do we go to something like a gross receipts tax when it's increasing at much greater rate than average inflation?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the purpose of it being tied to energy is that that portion of our entire budget could be attributed to those costs that would be going up or down with the cost of energy. As I said, fleet fuels, asphalt, and then many times construction costs will more follow those energy costs than they would just a general CPI for the entire economy. As we've seen the volatility, this is at least one that is at the gross receipts level because that's where the current fuel tax goes into the system. So just try to be as consistent as possible with the existing fuel tax. It only has a indexing feature that adjusts once a year, and it translates into a cents per gallon, as you point out, 17 cents. But it also, the idea of having a $2.50 floor, it might go above that, but it could also go down. And I think that is a more accurate kind of a reflector of MnDOT costs or our state transportation costs than simply having a one tied to CPI, which doesn't have a direct connection to our actual construction costs. So, again, it's only one element of, there's three others, the traditional fuel tax, the motor vehicle sales tax, and then the registration fees. All of them have a user bias toward the use of the system and generated by the use of the system.
Thank you. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one short, quick question. It's not a big deal, but it's the $49 million offset to increase the cost due to inflation. What inflation factor did you use? Is it a 3% or a 5%? What inflation rate factor did you use to come up with that $49 million? So I want to apply it to everything else that we look at here in the future. So I'm just looking at what's the constant rate you're looking at.
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, that actually is for the next 2 years, and it is a number of different components, which I can be happy to share with you. It is 1.8% in terms of a personnel cost, but there's, and I'm just doing some big features here, but it is salt, which is a big commodity cost for us, sand, asphalt, materials, So we have a number of components. Each one has a different cost item. So it overall is about 3% per year. I mean, if you gather them all together, but we actually have a spreadsheet that kind of is very specific, so I could share that.
Appreciate it. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, once again. So, as you're aware, the philosophy of the gas tax is, in part, users of roads and bridges infrastructure are those responsible for the continued maintenance and repair of the infrastructure. And a few minutes ago, you mentioned the increasing fuel efficiency of vehicles. But additionally, electric and hybrid vehicles are becoming more common. So drivers of electric and hybrid vehicles are no doubt creating wear and tear on the roads and bridges, but at the same time are not paying their fair share for the maintenance of the roads and bridges. So the governor's wholesale tax increase proposal will increasingly disproportionately thrust the burden of roads and bridges maintenance on the drivers of gas and diesel. So my question is, does the governor have any proposals to ensure that electric and hybrid drivers will pay their fair share for the wear and tear they are creating on the roads and bridges?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is not a specific proposal to add an additional tax for two reasons. One, that is a very, very small use of the system currently. Electric cars and, of course, hybrids do use fuel, but they get better gas mileage. But some small cars that are not hybrids get just as good or even greater fuel efficiency. So the fact that there are cars that are more fuel efficient is across the board an issue for users of the system. The electric cars, and I actually spent some time looking at this because I drive an electric car, that if you look at the first 5 years of a life of an electric car, the funds generated from the motor vehicle sales tax and the registration tax actually exceeds the same car that is a combustion engine car that burns fuel. So for the first 5 years, using average mileages for Minnesota drivers, the actual electric cars are contributing more to the highway trunk fund than the combustion car. And that is because that electric cars currently are selling at a 20% premium. They cost more than a traditional car. Now, that might not always be the case, but we think for this period of time, it's reasonable to kind of look at that. Keeping an eye as we look toward electric car usage in the future, there's certainly an opportunity for us to continue to study alternative methods like the mileage-based user fees, which we should look at all vehicles. And I think that will take a lot of debate and maybe 10 years, but we should be preparing for that.
Just a quick follow-up, just a quick comment. And you're right, it might be small percentage now, but you are looking at a 10-year plan, and it's going to increase. And as you mentioned, the 20% premium on the sales now won't always continue, especially when we look at the longer term. So thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Ms. Reth, I totally agree we should be continuing to keep watching that. It is kind of where we think it is today, but the world's changing quickly.
Okay. Members, we have time for one more question. Commissioner, we appreciate you being here. We may have to try and find a time that fits with your schedule and ask you back.
I'm happy to come back.
Thank you. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. I'll try and keep it quick, and I appreciate you saying that the gas tax or fuel tax is an imperfect one, and I understand, especially having you discuss going through your presentation, you know, how you're trying to mitigate some of that uncertainty or volatility. But that does make me curious as to maybe some of the assumptions behind some of the projections. You get to very concrete dollar amounts in what you're going to raise off of this. And so I'm curious if you can share with us kind of your assumptions behind those projections. And if not quickly here now, if we can get that on the committee. And then the second part, to save time is, again, coming up to very specific numbers a couple times in your slides, the outcomes will be 2,200 miles of roadway repair and replacement, 333 bridges. Do you break that down? Do we know which bridges, which lane miles those are, and what portion of the funds those are receiving, and could we get those as well?
Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, we will be happy to share the maps of the roadways we see as ending their measured useful life, which is where we determine that there would be repavement. But knowing that that's a model that with other kind of variable factors like weather and climate and use might alter it, but I think it's a pretty good snapshot as to and reasonable assumptions to look at the need. Yes, every bridge is cataloged and inspected, so we kind of know the condition, and we also know that with our experience of maintaining bridges, that over time they continue to deteriorate, they don't last forever. So part of what we view as efficiency with new revenue is to be able to make refurbishments and maintenance at the right time that extends the asset life rather than keep it shorter so that it's more expensive replacement, you know, later on. So I think the idea, philosophy behind this is to be smart about our investments as we are with any asset to ensure that we're being prudent with the taxpayer dollar.
Thank you. And thank you again, Commissioner. We appreciate you answering all of the questions and appreciate all the questions from all members. Members, we do plan on hearing bills on Monday. They'll be posted tomorrow. Correct. We, like we say, we'll be back with the Commissioner's office to see if we can, when we can arrange time to come back.
And this thank means you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You.